Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor at Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest this week is Tim Heligons, author of a new memoir called The Distance Between. Tim's memoir is an open and bracingly honest look at his life as a young man who battled addiction, who was involved in volatile relationships, and who also spent time in prison. Tim leaves no stone unturned in exploring why he did what he did, and he does so in gripping prose. We talk about the book and where he is today, and it was also a particularly enjoyable conversation as Tim is also a part of my church. I hope you enjoy it. Tim Heligons, thank you so much for being on the Failing Boldly podcast.
Absolutely. It's great to be here.
Well, the book was really one that I couldn't put down when I started getting into it. And so I talked about it a little bit in the intro about this memoir. Before we get into the book, though, I'm curious about the whole process of writing memoir. And the book takes the reader through your kind of early teen years up to about 19, 20 years old, essentially. And so can you tell me about both your interest in writing and then your decision to write memoir and to focus on this part of your life?
Well, I think my interest in writing probably started pretty early, just that I felt like it was a reasonable way for me to try to express myself. So it was, you know, angsty, terrible poetry as a teenager that eventually turned into what seemed like maybe they were short stories or short essays. And then as I sort of figured out who I wanted to be as a writer, I think the essay as an art form sort of just called to me, and it became the thing that I was writing that I didn't know I was writing until much, much later. And then from, I think, my sensibility towards writing essays, I realized that memoir was probably the genre that I wanted to write in. You know, everyone says you write what you know, and certainly for me, that's definitely been the case.
Did you struggle at all about how much to share? Because for those who haven't read the book yet, it's a pretty naked storytelling process of taking and abusing drugs, an incident of a couple of incidents of abuse done to your partner. And so did you, as you went into it, did you think I have to hold back, or did you go into it thinking I really have to tell the whole story?
I think I definitely wanted to hold back.
Okay.
And that's how I knew that I needed to not hold back. I mean, I wanted to write the most honest book that I could write, because I felt like, why write a book that's just about another man behaving badly? Because that story has been told millions of times. And I wanted to write a story that was about the mistakes that I'd made, but trying to render them with care and with certainly remorse, but also just with honesty, you know, that this is what happened and these are the things that I've done. And I think, though, in the early goings of this, I definitely wasn't as honest as I was trying to be. And I think that's what the revision process was for. You know, the more I revised, the more that I worked on it with my mentor and with other writers, the more, I suppose, the truth, you might call it, began to emerge. And I've just known, and I guess I've learned, that the thing for me is that when I feel the most uncomfortable, that's always the thing that I have to write.
Is that something that you know now, and just something that you've had to learn?
I think it's something that I had to learn.
Okay.
I think intuitively I may have known that, but I think it needed to be pointed out to me. And now I sort of have it jammed into my psyche that that's the way that it is.
When you wrote it, and in the process of writing it, my hunch is there's a part of you that feels like, this is somewhat cathartic for me. I want to tell my story in this creative way that's engaging to the reader. Did you also have in mind thinking about the reader? And I don't know if you wondered, I would love for the reader to get this out of it, or did you want to leave that open-ended and go at it saying, I'm going to tell my story However the reader engages with it is up to the reader.
Yeah. I think it's a little bit of both.
Okay.
I mean, the difference between, I think, writing a book and maybe journaling is one of them is concerned with the reader and one of them isn't, right? So maybe in the early first draft process, it was just about getting the story down and figuring out what parts of that story made sense to tell. And then as the revision process continued, it certainly became about the reader and the narrative arc and the themes that were emerging in the work.
How have, as you, I've described it a little bit, how have you described it? If somebody finds out that you wrote a book, how have you described it to others?
I'm literally the worst at describing it. I mean, I've tried to come up with an elevator pitch. I mean, the best that I could get is what the press gave me, which is just, it's a reckoning with toxic masculinity.
Okay. Do you think that's accurate?
I think it's accurate to a degree.
Okay.
I think it also just speaks to something that people are interested in right now. You know, certainly when I started writing the book, the term toxic masculinity wasn't as in vogue as it is now. So I don't know that I would have been able to describe it like that then. I mean, for me, it's like it's so many different things. I mean, it's a love story. It's a story about trying to figure out who I was. It's a story about trying to reconcile with the relationship that I didn't have with my biological father and vowing never to be like him and then becoming exactly like him and then figuring out how to, you know, how to deal with that.
For one of the things for me anyway was, I don't know if I've ever read a book that dealt so deeply and specifically with addiction. And there seemed like there were time and time again of either going too far with alcohol or drugs or whatever. You get called out on it in one way or another, sometimes by the police, sometimes by family, whatever. And maybe it's just because I'm so used to it. We're so used to Hollywood stories. And you think, okay, now here's the point where he's really going to turn around. He's going to realize he needs to do a 180 in his life. And you do maybe for a moment, but then just go back to those same behaviors. And so for me anyway, the story of addiction is the thing that really jumped out at me. And so is that something that you think is misunderstood about addiction and how people cope with it?
Yeah. And it's definitely maddening, you know, the cycle of addiction and the redundancy is in it and the monotony of it. I think addiction in general is misunderstood. Mm. You know, I don't know that we really as a society or even as a medical community understand very much about addiction other than some people can have alcohol and then be completely fine and then some people can't. There's like a flip that, you know, a switch that flips on and for some people it just never goes back off. That was the case with me. I had a friend who said that the thing that they got from the book was just the absolute frustration of watching someone make the same decision over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Which wasn't something I was thinking about when I was writing, but it was just the way that it happened, that, you know, you constantly make this decision that you're going to stop and not do the thing you're doing, and then you do it again. And you resolve not to do it, and then you do it again. And it's just over and over and over again until there's some sort of event or situation in your life that maybe gives you enough time and enough space to be sober and maybe start to make a different decision because your thinking starts to clear up. But it always takes the amount of pain that it takes for the person to get there, and some people never make it.
What was the response from people in your life, especially for those who are both for people in the book, say your parents, your mom and stepfather. And I'm curious about how your current wife responded to, because I mentioned to you before, I've known you for 3 or 4 years and know you as a really good guy. And in reading the book at times, I found myself finding it hard to feel sorry for you. And you kind of said before we started recording that that's a little bit of the point of it. And so for people who are in the book that you've talked to, what has been their response?
Well, for my parents, it was tough to read. Mm. I mean, they certainly lived parts of it with me, albeit from a different state. They were in Chicago. I was in Colorado. They were getting only what I was telling them. So for them to be in the minutia of it, to be in that pain again, and then to be in it in the way that books bring you into scenarios like that, it was really tough. So my mom read it. She told me she put it off, read it in 3 days. And then when I called her to talk about it, she was like, look, I just can't talk to you about this right now. I just need some time to process it, which I understood. With my wife, with Erin, I hope it's okay that I said her name. Sorry, Erin. We kind of had this agreement where I was going to wait until it was pretty far down the road. So it was when it was in its final stages, I kind of walked into the bathroom where she was taking a bath one night. She likes to do that to relax. And I was just like, look, I got to give you this thing. It's eventually going to be out in the world. I certainly want you to know everything that's in it before it's out there. And then if anything needs to be talked about or changed, we should do that now. So she spent the next couple of nights in the bathtub reading it. And then maybe two or three nights later, I walked in there and she just looked at me and she was like, you were such an a-hole. And she was like legitimately mad at me. Yeah. And I was like, I totally was. I understand exactly what you mean. So it was hard for her, but she seems to be able, I mean, she doesn't know that me.
Does she, before, like, as you were dating, I would imagine that you're telling her, this is part of my story, you have to know who I am. But I guess one of the things that's, again, striking about the book is just how much detail you go into. And so you can tell somebody, I was an addict, you know, I was arrested, whatever, but you're not really going into the,
right,
the nitty gritty of it.
Right.
And so it's maybe, quote unquote, easy for somebody to say, well, that was you then. You're different now. I know that. But then to really read about what kind of person you were, I would imagine to be, it was hard for, like I said, it was hard for me a little bit to read, like, this is not the person I know. And so for you to really go in depth like that, I wondered about how that affects your current relationships, if it has at all.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a little bit of a disconnect for some of the people that read it because of the fact that they know me now, and this just seems like a story someone's telling them about a character, mm-hmm, or about another person. So there's a disconnect between that person and the person that I am now, which I'm obviously totally fine with. But I mean, most other people have been, I don't know, gracious in their reading of it, and I think brought a lot of understanding to it. And I think generally people just like to be entertained, you know, so watching the car crash in some ways is, you know, pretty entertaining.
Yeah. Car chase and car crash.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You, at the very beginning of the book, you name, and I'm pretty open about the fact that, I'm paraphrasing here, so correct me if I'm going too far off the paraphrase, but noting that you probably cut some bricks because you're white. Right. So let's stay with that first. And so why did you feel you had to name that, kind of before we started reading your story?
Yeah, the prologue to the book, came much later. So I wrote this book over the course of 5 years. So I felt like in a lot of ways I was a different person, and I had really done a lot of learning and had grown a lot as a person in the course of that 5 years. So the way that I understood my story when I first began writing it wasn't the same way that I understood it when I finished writing it. I realized during the course of that time that I think a good portion of the way that I was able to recover and the ways that I was able to recover was because I had a couple of things going for me, certainly white privilege and male privilege. And there were just things that happened here in Chicago, Laquan McDonald, mm-hmm, for example, where when that video came out and I watched, mm-hmm, it for the first time and I saw him 5 miles from where I grew up, I think, is where he was shot. And he reminded me so much of myself just in the fact that he was young and he was angry and he was just making bad decisions, but he wasn't necessarily a bad kid, just like I felt like I was young and angry and making bad decisions, but wasn't necessarily a bad kid. But the big difference between him and I was he was black and he was shot dead on the street, and I was right, and I was white, and I was arrested. And then ultimately let out of jail at some point, and then am living the life that I'm living now. So it doesn't explain everything, but it explains some things. And I think that was a really big personal revelation to me. And it felt like I needed to get out in front of that.
Talk a little bit about, too, you mentioned the phrase toxic masculinity earlier. What does that phrase, I guess, mean to you? And how does that phrase connect with the book? I mean, is that something that you wanted to contribute to that whole kind of national conversation around toxic masculinity? Or my hunch is when you first started writing it, it wasn't necessarily something that you thought about, but maybe that's it's come along as the book went further.
Right. Well, there was certainly an idea of vulnerability that was in there from the beginning. And I think there's a lot of different ways that you can define toxic masculinity, but maybe one easy way is just that it's sort of an oppressive archetype that's for males that's concerned with rejecting anything feminine, with being stoic and decisive all the time, with sexual prowess, but a very limited one-dimensional view of what masculinity is instead of what I think it is, which is in many ways very much like femininity in the sense that we experience a whole spectrum of emotions and that we're more alike than we are different. And that if we're living into this one-dimensional perspective of masculinity, we're actually not living into the fullness of our humanity. I think that something that happens when people look at men, certain people look at men, is think that they can't be vulnerable, they can't admit when they were wrong. So I did want to be able to at least do those things in the book, be vulnerable, admit that I had made these mistakes, and admit for me something that was deeply shaming and shameful, which was the fact that I was an abuser. For all intents and purposes, I was in a relationship and I abused my partner verbally over and over and over again, and on two occasions physically. And it's haunted me for years and years and years. But what good is it for me to have that story and that experience and to really feel like I have learned and changed and carved out a different type of life because of that experience and not share it? How is that? I mean, to me, it was like, how is that contributing to working against toxic masculinity if I just don't talk about it?
Have you found that people have been appreciative, the fact that you have been so open about it and talked about it, and or there have been people who have been upset that you mentioned it or talked about it?
Well, most people have been, you know, fairly compassionate and nice about it. But, I mean, there was one pretty big loss that I suffered because of it, which maybe isn't a good way to phrase it, but was I lost the first book deal, because it was right around the time that, so I had sold it to a university press. I had worked with the nonfiction series editor on it. It was pretty far down the line. And then I got an email saying that the press was not going to publish the book and they were going to sever the contract because they felt like they couldn't get behind the book from a perpetrator's point of view, which is sort of what it is. And they just didn't feel like there was going to be the nuance in America to be able to understand that. And so, I mean, I was so disappointed, but I understood their decision. But that was certainly the harshest consequence that I suffered from it. I think there have to be people who are, not happy about it. And I think that maybe I just haven't heard as much from those people. But it also felt like the beginning of the book was also meant to sort of let people know, and I guess in a way that sort of a trigger warning is, that if you have this experience and it's written in the way that I've written it in the book, it may be difficult to read, and I want you to know that going into it.
Yeah. Are the struggles that you had as and that was one thing I needed to keep reminding myself of, and was a little bit blown away by, is that, well, I got to remind myself, he's 19 here, and dealing with all of these life things at such a young age. But are some of the core struggles that you dealt with, you mentioned earlier, like your relationship with both your biological and stepfather, your sense of place in the world, are those struggles that you have today, or are they different?
Yeah, that's a great question, because some of them, I think, are still the same. I think you're getting at, like, how much of what I was dealing with is innate in me, like this sense of self. I think I'm definitely the type of person that needs affirmation. And so I'm going to seek out that affirmation in many, many different ways. And now, as an older person, I understand that there's healthy ways to do that and unhealthy ways to do that. I don't know that I really understood that at 17, 18, and 19. So it was just about affirmation or attention, sort of anywhere I could get it. The struggles now are different than they were back then, for sure. I mean, say more about
what. Well, my sense for you as a late teenager is, which for all of us at that age is, like, I'm trying to figure out my place in the world. Mm. And in the book, the late teenager you tries to find that in different ways. And so for you today, is that still a bit of a struggle? Like, what is my place in the world? And I guess, how do you wrestle with it now?
Yeah, I don't think it's as much of a struggle anymore. I mean, I think maybe every writer struggles with that a little bit. I mean, so much of my writing, I think, does deal with identity and my sense of purpose and just exploring different ideas around that. But I don't struggle with it the same way that I did when I was younger. I think I've become so much more comfortable in sobriety, in who I am as a person. I think a lot of the decisions that I made as a teenager were definitely because I was just trying to find where I fit in. You know, I mean, I think in some ways it was like rebelling. I read a writer who talked about rebelling against whiteness. And maybe that's in some way what I was doing and didn't realizing it. So I was trying to, you know, be in different places around different types of people to have different experiences that felt, I guess, more real to me or felt more important. And then I get to Colorado and I make all these decisions and I want to hang out with a bunch of gangsters and I want to do a bunch of drugs because it's all about feeling something different than what I was feeling, which was just probably good old fashioned feeling out of place, you know, and just looking for ways to not feel like that.
How long did it take you when you got home to kind of make peace with that, not make peace with that, but just begin to get out of that mindset? Because it sounds like in the book that was a pretty heavy thing that you kept thinking about yourself, and that you knew you were more than just this cycle of drugs and getting arrested and everything else. And there's that sense of failure that sets in. So how long did it take you after the book, or after what's written about in the book, for you to kind of get out of that cycle of feeling like a failure and then going to unhealthy ways of trying to deal with that?
I mean, it took a while, you know, and I think a lot of that, I mean, these are the internal thoughts that go through our heads, right? So I think if you ask my friends at the time, you know, they're not going to say that I was constantly feeling like a failure, but on the inside, for sure, you know, that I was trying to do these things and none of it was working out and I couldn't figure out why. And so it just felt like I was this gigantic, epic failure. I don't think it was until 5 years after I had been home that started to change, really, when I got sober.
Okay.
You know, I went to rehab and then just started rethinking things. And it wasn't that I was a failure. It was that I was doing the wrong things that weren't helping me succeed in certain areas of my life. And I think once I understood that, that there's actually this whole other set of steps that I could be taking and things that I could be doing that would be pushing me towards a more positive direction and helping me to accomplish certain things, then it started to change.
Yeah, yeah. Is part of that thinking or trying to figure out the sense of, let's see if I can phrase this right. When you had a sense of your failure, is that because you had in your mind, this is what I should be doing as quote unquote a successful person, whether for you personally or for me as we talked about masculinity earlier, as a man, I should be doing these things. Was that part of that process for you? And then did you have a sense after maybe getting sober, kind of reshape what it means to be a man or what does it mean to be a successful Tim Hillegons? Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I had all these ideas in my head that weren't matching up with what the reality of my life was. So in my head, I wanted to be a successful, independent adult. And I was an 18-year-old, you know, with $80 in my pocket from working at Denny's in a bad relationship. And so that always felt like a failure because it wasn't this successful thing that I had in my head. Then I became a father and I had an idea of what a good father was going to be, mostly because I thought about all the ways in which my biological father wasn't a good father to me and had vowed that I was going to be different. And then when I became a father, I wasn't like the way that I had anticipated I would be. I was completely the opposite of that. So that felt like a failure. And then as a man in a relationship coming from a, you know, a really patriarchal sensibility, so my thought was, I'm in this relationship, I've got to be the man who works, I've got to bring in the money, I've got to make the decisions, I've got to make sure everything gets done at home and everybody's living good lives and has everything they need. And the reality was is I wasn't doing any of those things because I didn't have a very good job and I didn't have very much money and I wasn't a good father and I wasn't a good partner. So that completely felt like a failure. And so it wasn't until I stopped doing some of those things for sure, but then realizing that I can define my own sense of self and that this idea that I had about becoming a man was really just an idea about becoming an adult. And so once it wasn't about gender, and then I realized that this idea of manhood can be completely interpreted in whatever way you want it to be interpreted, that became very liberating and very freeing for me.
And I think that's hard for any man, regardless of what your background is, of the archetype of what it is. And when you can get to that point that you described really well of kind of freeing yourself, like there's no archetype. There's my path. And so I think that's a struggle for lots of people, men or women.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and I'm certainly not one that's got it all figured out now. I just know that it's a lot bigger than what I thought it was.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot more freedom in this thing. And there's certain like traits about traditional masculinity that can be oppressive, but can also be really good, you know? So being, you know, stoic is good sometimes, you know, being decisive is good sometimes, you know, being a hard worker is good sometimes, you know, all these different things can be really good. It's just figuring out where the line is for you individually.
Yeah. Can I ask, how's your relationship now with your, especially with your daughter and your parents?
With my daughter, it's better than it's ever been. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that she's older now. You know, I think there's just raising teenagers is tough, you know, and we have a very non-traditional parent-child relationship where we don't see each other a ton, but we talk all the time. So it's different, you know, sort of unconventional that way, but it's also just, it's better than it's ever been.
Are you hyper aware because she's a little older than you were when you from the book? Is that right?
Yeah, so she's about to be 22. Okay. She'll be 22 on the 20th.
As she reached those years, were you hyper aware of her life and just as you thought back to your own experiences, and you're like,
yeah.
Did you give her a lot of please don't do this or that or the other thing, or did you just kind of let her live her life and then?
Yeah, I mean, I tried not to be like the overbearing.
Right.
Don't do this. I've been down this road. I mean, not that she would listen anyway, but I mean, the one thing that I did, I remember when she turned 19, when I sent her her birthday card that year, I just said, you, right now, today, you have turned the same age that I was when I had you. So just think about that for a second. And I think, at least in my mind, that maybe gave her pause.
Yeah.
You know, to think about what was going on in her life at that exact moment and then think about what it would be like to have a baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
And how about the relationship with your parents now?
It's really good. I mean, my relationship with my parents changed a lot when I got sober. I mean, so many of my relationships did. My parents and I, during the years that I was sort of reestablishing my relationship with Haley, I remember I would, in those early years, I would fly from Chicago to Denver and then drive from Denver to where Haley lives. And there would be an hour worth of time that I would usually talk to my stepfather, and we would just talk and just connect in a completely different way than we ever did when I was younger. And, you know, he gave me some really good advice then about how to approach things with Haley. And I don't know, it was like, I remember that time in my life, because it was over the span of years and years, you know, that I would fly to Denver, make this drive, make the drive back, fly home, you know, over and over again. And we often talked, and it became, you know, really good. With my mom, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm such a mama's boy. So, you know, we've always been good. I mean, she definitely, I definitely drove her nuts and, you know, drove her to the edge.
Yeah.
When I was younger, but it's good, you know. I mean, at some point you just grow up and things change.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Well, I always end these conversations by asking someone to tell a story of failure. And before we talked, I said, I know there are plenty in the book. And so I don't know if you want to tell one of the stories from the book or if there's another one that you wanted to share today.
Yeah. Well, one thing that comes to mind was when I got sober, so I was 26, and I remember I was sitting in rehab and I made this promise to myself that I was going to learn how to box and I was going to fight in the Golden Gloves. And, so got out of rehab, a few years went by, made it into a boxing gym, started to learn a few things, eventually moved to Baltimore, and Golden Gloves was coming around, usually happens in March. And so I signed up to fight in Sugar Ray Leonard's gym in Palmer Park, Maryland. So I was going to fight at 178, which was a little bit bigger than I was at the time, but didn't mean that I had to lose a bunch of weight. So I train and feel like I'm in pretty good shape. And at the same time, I'm working a lot and trying to balance all these other things and going to a lot of meetings. And eventually the day of the fight comes, and I'm the 16th person on the card. So I'm literally the last fight of the night. So I'm sitting there in this gym watching all these fights happen, waiting to be the last person to go up there. And I drew a kid from Baltimore who was fighting out of a gym in Baltimore, and we get in the ring, and I just look at him, and I'm like, I don't know how this is going to end. And so we start moving around a little bit, and we get about halfway through the first round, and he just cracks me with a right hook, like right hook, left hand combo, and just drops me to one knee, and I'm like, this is not happening. And I stand back up and must have had some sort of look in my eye, like I didn't want to continue, and the ref puts me in the neutral corner and then says, just keep hitting the gym, and calls the fight.
Wow.
So it's over in like a minute after all this time. And I was devastated because I felt like I had just let myself down, like that I didn't lose because of talent. I lost because I beat myself because I was just so scared going into it. So I've definitely thought about that over the years, and I never fought again. I mean, I've boxed a lot since then, but I never fought in the gloves again. And I feel like it's one of those things where I'm just always going to think about it.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there you have it.
Well, thanks for sharing that. Well, the book is The Distance Between. It's a great book, and highly recommend it for folks to really read a vulnerable, well-written look at a life that was trying to figure out its own life. And so, Tim, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Tim for giving his time for this conversation. To learn more about Tim and his writings, you can go to his website, timhilligons.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at timhilligons and Instagram at tim_hilligons. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to christiankuhn.com. And I hope you'll consider subscribing to this podcast via Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I put out new episodes on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month. Thanks again for listening. And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Susanna for giving her time for this conversation. To learn more about the Epic Fail Game, you can go to theepicfailgame.com.au, and you can also find them on Instagram and Facebook at The Epic Fail Game. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to my website, christiankuhn.com. Please consider subscribing to this podcast via Apple Podcasts or Spotify. My next conversation is with Tim Hilligons, the author of the recently published memoir, The Distance Between. Thanks again for listening.